Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Ian Williams, UN correspondent with The Nation magazine, who discusses the ongoing carnage in Lebanon and the major obstacles preventing a ceasefire. Author Martha Burke, who analyzes why U.S. foreign policy supports regimes that repress women's rights in order to satisfy the interests of big oil. And Zoe Chafee of the World Watch Institute, who examines the role of natural disasters such as desertification in the conflict that has raged in the Darfur region of Sudan since 2003. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After 47 years as head of state, Fidel Castro, who turns 80 on August 13th, has provisionally delegated power to his younger brother Raul Castro. Cuba's leader recently underwent abdominal surgery for a sharp intestinal crisis with sustained bleeding, a condition he said was caused by extreme stress and overwork. In an address read to the Cuban people on Monday, July 31st, by Fidel Castro's secretary, the Cuban leader announced his decision to provisionally transfer power to various other members of his cabinet. Castro also requested that any celebration of his birthday be postponed until December 2nd of this year, the 50th anniversary of the Granma Landing, which launched the Cuban Revolution. The news of Castro's condition was greeted in the Little Havana section of Miami, Florida, with celebration and near pandemonium. The right-wing Cuban exile community has flooded the streets by the hundreds, waving flags and prematurely cheering for what some have been waiting to happen for decades: Fidel Castro's death and ultimate fall from power. Lucius Walker is co-founder of Pastors for Peace, based in New York City. He and many others just recently returned from Cuba after the 17th Cuban caravan of humanitarian aid was delivered to the island nation without a license and in defiance of the U.S. blockade against Cuba. He says Cuban President Fidel Castro carefully and wisely delegated power so as not to create a crisis situation, and the reaction from the extremists in Miami should come as no surprise. Addressing the question of what will happen in Cuba in the event of Fidel Castro's death, Reverend Walker stated that members of the national leadership know their jobs well, and the government of Cuba will be in capable hands. Europe's intense heat wave is putting a strain on the production of nuclear energy. This comes at a time when British Prime Minister Tony Blair is promoting the expansion of nuclear power to combat global warming. On July 24th, French authorities allowed wastewater from nuclear plants to be discharged at higher than normal temperatures into local rivers, possibly damaging water ecology. France relies on nuclear power for 80% of its electricity, and half of all nuclear plants use rivers as outlets for their cooling systems. The French government did the same thing during the deadly 2003 heat wave, which killed 15,000 people, primarily senior citizens. The higher wastewater temperatures lead to a buildup in concentrations of ammoniac, which can be toxic to river fauna. According to the Interpress service, Germany has reduced output at several nuclear power plants to limit the rise in temperatures of their cooling system water and to protect the river environment. Spain has gone so far as to shut down one of its older nuclear plants along the Ebro River due to a rise in river water temperature. Hermann Scheer of Eurosolar asserts, "We must invest in renewable energy sources and get rid of nuclear power as soon as possible." American corporate profits have risen to a 40-year high point, while wage stagnation has plagued the U.S. high-tech economy. San Francisco web designer David Lewis makes a good salary at $77,000 a year, but has had only one wage increase in 5 years. Meanwhile, the cost of food, rent, and raising a young daughter has risen steadily. According to the Los Angeles Times, wages for workers with a four-year college education fell by 5.2% from 2000 to 2004. It is the first time in 30 years that wages for college-educated workers has fallen. During the high-tech boom of the 1990s, college graduates saw inflation-adjusted earnings rise by over 12%. Educated technology workers are also feeling pressure from globalization and the exporting of service jobs to Mexico and India, which depress wages in American engineering and software design. Northeastern University economist Paul Harrington says half of all the jobs created since 2001 have been for so-called contingent workers, such as contractors or part-timers who don't receive health or pension benefits. Increasingly, there is a growing gray-collar workforce of college-educated employees who are working below their skill level in retail establishments such as bookstores and coffee shops and are struggling to earn a living wage. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and Denise Manzari. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
As Israel's assault on Lebanon entered its fourth week, the rising number of civilian casualties has provoked worldwide calls for an unconditional ceasefire, a move blocked by Israel and the Bush administration. Israel's July 25th attack on a United Nations outpost in southern Lebanon, killing four peacekeepers, followed by the July 30th airstrike on an apartment building in the city of Qana, killing 56 Lebanese civilians, including 34 children, further angered the international community. Television images of dozens of dead children in Qana unleashed rage against Israel and the U.S. across the Arab world. The attack on the U.N. compound was preceded by 10 calls to the Israeli military from U.N. personnel, warning them that their artillery shells were striking dangerously close to the outpost. U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan said he was shocked and deeply distressed by the apparently deliberate targeting of a U.N. observer post. He called on Israel to conduct a full investigation. Following the Qana incident, Israel agreed to a 48-hour cessation of airstrikes in Lebanon, but quickly broke that pledge. On July 31st, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert announced his government would widen its ground offensive in Lebanon. In response to the escalating conflict, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has placed his military on full alert. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ian Williams, U.N. correspondent with The Nation magazine, who discusses the ongoing carnage in Lebanon and the major obstacles preventing a ceasefire.
The United States line is that Israel is stamping out Hezbollah and, in effect, doing the Lebanese government's work for it. And people who haven't paid much regard to U.N. resolutions hitherto have all said that there must be immediate implementation of Resolution 1559, which calls for the disarmament of militias. But it seems that not many people in Lebanon actually want to disarm Hezbollah, including the government. So we're sort of in the position of forcing a government to do things that it doesn't want to do in the name of its own sovereignty, which, you know, is even more silly than usual.
Ian, the United States ostensibly supported the Cedar Revolution, got Syrian troops out of Lebanon, and now with the Israeli attacks on Hezbollah, their star is rising in Lebanon and across the world. What will Hezbollah's future role be in the Lebanese government now that this incursion has strengthened it?
Well, you have to remember that over 40% of the population of Lebanon, at least, are Shia. They're the biggest single community in Lebanon. They're grossly underrepresented in the government because the so-called Cedar Revolution was actually sort of fought and campaigned for on boundaries and decisions that were made 70 years ago when the disposition of the population was entirely different, and that's been frozen ever since. Now, the politicians want to keep it that way, but ordinary Lebanese, there was a poll today from James Zogby that shows that the majority of Lebanese, both Shia and Sunni, support Hezbollah. The majority of Lebanese don't want Hezbollah to be disarmed. The majority of them are totally against Israel, that's including the Christians. There was actually a higher proportion of Lebanese looked favorably on Syria than on the United States. How is that for a comment on the liberation movement and the Cedar Revolution?
So things have turned completely around and certainly undercut whatever advantage the U.S. and Israel thought they would get out of this military operation.
Yes. I think so. But it's also about elections as well. I mean, it's a neocon delusion that elections in the Middle East will solve the problem in the way that they want. Any rational Kissinger-type real politic guy or the Israelis themselves would tell them that, in fact, it's much better to have a reactionary regime like Saddam Hussein or the Saudi monarchy that you can do business with than have an elected government or one that's susceptible to popular pressure, because the number one issue, poll after poll has shown, right across the Arab world, all the way from Morocco on the Atlantic down to Oman on the Gulf and the Indian Ocean, is Palestine. Because right across the Arab world, they look at Palestine and they see people being humiliated and mistreated for being Arabs. So they resonate the same way that Africans did for South Africa under apartheid. Yes, they have their own daily humiliations from their own governments, but that was for being human, whereas in South Africa they were being humiliated for being black and African. And the rest of the Arab world sees what's happening in Gaza and the West Bank, and they see Bantustans, they see apartheid, they see all of that apparatus, and they resonate to it. And it really is the number one issue right across the board in every Arab country, even Kuwait.
Ian, I wanted to ask you this. With widespread outrage across the world as to the carnage occurring now in Lebanon and the hundreds of Lebanese civilians have been killed and injured, almost a million displaced by this conflict launched by Israel, what's the power of the United Nations to demand an unconditional ceasefire and stop the killing?
Well, its power is pretty considerable, but its power only works if the U.S. stops vetoing. And at the moment, the most powerful member of the United Nations is the United States. And when the United States wants the UN to do something and the rest of the world agrees, then it can be pretty powerful pretty quickly. But as we've seen, if the United States vetoes it, then it's very difficult for anyone to do anything. I think the U.S. is really putting the Europeans and the rest of the world in a very sticky position, is that their publics are revolted by what's happening, and they're saying, what are you doing about it? You know, last year, 191 countries agreed that the UN had the responsibility to protect. They had the right to stop countries causing massive violations of human rights. But, you know, you can't get a much more massive violation than killing civilians on a wholesale way like this. And yet, nobody's acting. So, the US is not just supporting Israel, it's actually in a not-so-subtle way destroying international law and the United Nations with its attitude.
What about the dangers of a wider conflict? There's a lot of speculation that the neocons in Washington have a blueprint for a wider war with Syria and Iran. In terms of Lebanon, do you think that will be a spark that could cause a wider war?
The Syrians are gearing up their army. The Israelis are being very provocative. They're blowing up bridges on the way. They're buzzing the capital. They're making all sorts of gestures. I think the one drawback to all of this is basically that the Israeli plan has already failed. I mean, they've been banging away, and they barely made it inside of Lebanon. And the one town which they were claiming they'd taken a week ago, they probably had to pull out from because Hezbollah, well, gave them a good whacking. And they're not used to resistance like this. They're used to sort of set piece armies that dissolve and run, or they're to bombing men, women, and children on the ground in villages. So the idea of people who sort of pop up from behind rocks and take shots at them right next to with anti-tank grenades and missiles is something that's very disconcerting. I think for all of the saber rattling and the talk about extending the conflict, they might well go in deeper, but it's unlikely to bring them much in the way of satisfaction.
That was Ian Williams, author of The United Nations for Beginners, published by Writers and Readers. Read his articles on the United Nations in the pages of The Nation magazine and online at www.thenation.com. In January 2002, 3 months after the U.S. launched the post-9/11 war to overthrow the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, President Bush said, "I like to remind my fellow Americans, there's nothing more joyous to my heart than to see our military liberate women who have lived under the most oppressive regime in the history of mankind." But more than 4 years after Mr. Bush made those remarks, the repression of women in Afghanistan continues. Violence against women and girls is rampant in the country, with domestic and sexual abuse and forced marriages common. 90% of school-age girls in southern Afghanistan do not attend classes, likely linked to the fact that more than 300 girls' schools have been burned or bombed. In the aftermath of the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq and the subsequent overthrow of Saddam Hussein, women have seen many of their rights disappear in favor of a constitution based on Islamic law. In her recent cover article for Ms. Magazine titled, "Crude Awakening, U.S. Policies in Afghanistan and Iraq Sell Out Women in Favor of Oil," Martha Burke explains the connections between the Bush administration's wars and America's thirst for oil. She spoke with Between the Lines' Scott Harris about why U.S. foreign policy so readily sacrifices women's rights to satisfy the interests of big energy corporations.
I'm certainly not the first person to say that the Iraq war is an oil war, or really the Afghanistan war either, although the immediate provocation, as we know, was 9/11. But I think that looking at it through a gender lens, and who, you know, it's always good to ask who pays who profits. And in this case, in the Middle East, it's women who are paying the price, with their basic freedoms being compromised. And our government, and I have to say it's not just Bush's, in Afghanistan, this started under Clinton when the Taliban took over and literally put women under house arrest, sent them home from their jobs in the middle of the day, forced them to cover head to toe, not go out without a male relative, could not work, could not see a male doctor, could not go to school. The Clinton administration was still willing to recognize that unelected tyrannical regime as the official government of Afghanistan. And the reason they were considering it is because UNICAL, which is now Chevron, wanted to put an oil pipeline across the country. And our government wanted them to have that pipeline. And there was some competition with an Australian company. The Bush administration, in going to war with Iraq, once the WMDs were proven to be false and the various other reasons that they gave, they started to fall back on, but we're liberating the women in Iraq. And that's just not true. The women in Iraq have fewer rights now than they did under Saddam Hussein. Their protections under the Constitution are weaker than they were under the old Constitution. And so this is the hypocrisy that is going on over there now and will continue.
Now, how do you propose that we here in America address this issue, particularly about the link between the quest for oil, the resource wars, and the abusive policies of many of these same countries who supply oil to the U.S. and their policies towards women?
Well, one of the things that we have to do in a very large sense is reduce our dependence on oil, and whether that is a personal dependence or dependence in a larger sense in the economy. We need to quit buying all that junk at Walmart that's piled to the ceiling, plastic doll buggies and plastic flip-flops and all this junk that is made out of petroleum that we don't need. Half the time we probably don't even want it. We just find it because it's there and it's cheap because we're exploiting labor in China. So we need to reduce our dependence on oil, but we also need to pay attention to whose policies are in place and who we're voting for. You know, this is an election year. We need to look at the people we're sending to Congress. Are they willing to put some money out there for alternative energy? Who has spoken up and said Dick Cheney's secret energy task force was wrong? He needs to be investigated for that. And who has remained silent? And I think what we'll find is that most people have remained silent in the Congress, whether they're either side of the aisle.
And how do you think we could leverage our buying power in terms of the oil in these oil-rich countries to really provide options for people now living in an oppressive state? You think we could leverage the same kind of pressure that our country has often and other countries do in terms of just general democratic rights?
Well, we probably could, but we don't have the political will to do it. And that is really what the whole Ms. article is about. If it comes down to the rights of big oil and big oil getting its mitts on the reserves in the Middle East versus the rights of women, oil is going to win every time. So, you know, we just flatly do not have the political will to say, look, we're not going to do business with you. We're not going to safeguard these oil fields. We're not going to aid transport of this oil and so on and on and on and on unless you straighten up on human rights, women's rights, and democracy in general. We don't care about that right now. What we care about is ExxonMobil, BP, Chevron, all the rest of them. We want to make sure that Dick Cheney and George Bush, the first oil presidency, safeguard the rights of their buddies. And that's what it comes down to. You know, the Congress called these guys, these CEOs in front of them, to talk about excess profits here in the USA, which that's hurting all of us too. and allowed them to get away with saying, oh, we're not making excess profits. This is just normal business. It seems that we are safeguarding the rights of the oil companies very carefully, but we're selling out the rights of women in order to get this oil. And I think that is a connection that we all need to be making.
That was Martha Burke, author of the book, Cult of Power, Sex Discrimination in Corporate America, and What Can Be Done About It. Read her article, Crude Awakening, in the summer 2006 edition of Ms. Magazine, or visit the publication's website at www.msmagazine.com. The embattled region of Darfur in western Sudan is in an area of the world that faces increasing desertification, literally the spread of desert-like areas where agriculture is often no longer viable. The United Nations has declared 2006 the International Year of Deserts and Desertification to focus world attention on the problem. In these areas, which affect one-third of the Earth's surface and 1 billion people, topsoil blows away at a rate 16 times faster than it can be replaced. In sub-Saharan Africa, including Darfur, the growing scarcity of natural resources such as water and arable land have contributed to conflicts among the different groups of peoples living there. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Zoe Chafee, a staff researcher at the Washington, D.C.-based World Watch Institute, which works on sustainability issues. She studies the relationship between natural disasters and conflict. Chafee explains the role of disasters such as desertification in the backstory of the violence that has raged in Darfur since 2003. The conflict there has led to the deaths of almost 500,000 people and the displacement of another 2 million.
In Darfur, you have a case where there are people who have historically been farmers and used the land, and then another group of people who have been primarily nomadic. And these people have interacted in different ways throughout history. And usually, in the best case, the farmers have been able to exchange the crops that they grow or lend out their fields in return for the nomad services, whether it be milk or meats that they bring in. And in often cases, it was a mutually beneficial relationship. But in recent years, with drought continually pressing on the region and disturbance on the political levels in Sudan as a whole, the two groups have often conflicted instead of cooperated, and this has led to quite a horrific genocide.
Say a little more about how scarcity of natural resources has played out among the different groups in Darfur.
The farmers have often used land in ways that we would imagine in terms of, you know, crops growing on certain patches of land, and often that land is the most fertile and has water close to it. And as nomads come in search of water, there tends to be quite a bit of disagreement over who has the rights to the water. In the past, there was often negotiations that would go on the village level, and there was sort of a traditional way of working out when the nomads would get access to the water and when the farmers would be able to use it themselves. With a breakdown in communication and increasing pressure because of the lack of water, the conflict has turned increasingly violent. And now there's cases where nomads are coming in and actually taking over villages, and farmers are forced to defend themselves, and I'm sure that the conflict goes the other direction as well. So really what we see is that as desertification begins to impact Darfur more and more, and drought as well, water becomes a precious resource and one that lives are lost over in many cases.
Is there a direct correlation between the farmers being the black Africans who have been the victims of genocide in Darfur and the nomads being the Arabs known as the Janjaweed who have been killing the Darfurians with the support of the Sudanese government? Is there that correlation or not?
From the research that I have read, from people who have written from the field, it does sound as though the farmers are typically of more African origin and the nomads tend to be more of Arab origin. And the nomads are somewhat associated with these groups of Janjaweed, as they're called, that are coming in and receiving support from the government to pillage villages. However, I don't know that that's a 100% correlation.
Zoe Chafee, you wrote in your editorial in World Watch magazine that the most dangerous time for the refugees is when the women and girls must leave the camps to search for firewood.
That's right. And in many cases, the women are spending up to 6 hours of their day looking for firewood outside of camp. And what you see is that they're moving away from the safer areas where there is some sort of a social cohesiveness or a community that might be able to defend them. And they're basically out on their own as they travel farther and farther from the refugee camp to get firewood. You can sort of imagine a growing circle of deforestation around each camp, where each day they have to walk a bit farther and a bit farther to find the wood that they need just to feed their families and to heat up water so that it can be consumed and not make them sick.
You mentioned that while it won't solve the underlying conflict, just providing simple stoves to these women would increase their margin of safety quite noticeably. What are those stoves like, and who would provide them?
The stoves are basically simple technologies that allow women to cook in a more insulated environment. So basically, the wood that they're using or whatever materials they're burning are burned more efficiently, and I believe that it increases the heat in this, you know, over the stove area, and it also decreases the risk from respiratory disease from the smoke as well, because the fire needs to cook for less time.
Is global warming likely to exacerbate these existing problems, or have you seen any evidence of that already?
Yeah, I think there is a huge risk that global warming is going to increase the types of problems that we're seeing in Darfur. Already, the types of disasters that I study, the natural disasters of the world, are not so natural anymore. They're actually more of unnatural disasters, because global warming, which is often linked to human activities, and that couples with population growth, people living in areas that are increasingly risky to their own health, it's really creating sort of mega disasters. And oftentimes these disasters are not as swift as a tsunami or an earthquake. They're more creeping disasters like desertification and drought, which don't make the headlines. And to me, those are some of the most dangerous disasters, because people affected by them often aren't brought the help that they need from outside until it's too late. So I think we really are going to see an increase in some devastating disasters, especially related to drought, over the next coming years as weather becomes more erratic, especially in Africa. And it's something that the global community is really going to have to pay close attention to.
That was Zoe Chafee of the World Watch Institute. Contact the Institute at area code 202-452-1992 or visit their website at www.worldwatch.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.